Next, we have Dr. David Clements. Dr. Clements is a professor of biology in the departments of biology, geology, and the environment at Trinity Western University. He's focused on plant ecology, especially the ecology of weeds, which we agreed is just depends on what you love and don't love. With that, Dr. Clements.
Great. Thanks, Sharon. And thanks for attending the talk instead of hanging out with the Puerto Rican party there. So when we read this Genesis account of the temptation of Adam and Eve, the question there is, did God really say not to eat that fruit? But of course, there's other words in Genesis, and notably this command in Genesis 2:15 to serve and protect the garden. And like the other words that God instructs us with, we often fail to respond to them, to be obedient. And so now we are facing the sins of the Anthropocene. And the Anthropocene is, as I'll talk about, is this new age where human influence over the environment is staggeringly large. On my way here on the plane, I was reading a book called The Last Drop, which describes what's happening to our water supplies all over the earth, and it's one of the scariest books I've ever read, and it's about the Anthropocene, obviously. I love this painting I discovered. Johann Peter did this in the 17th century, and he had access, apparently, to a lot of very accurate specimens through his commission from the Pope, I believe. So I really love it for the diversity there. So as well as being a presentation this afternoon, this is also a call for papers. And this came out of last year's meeting when many of us noticed that there was a nice amount of environmental presentations at the meeting in Mississauga. And so thanks to Janelle Curry's initiative, we decided to do a call for papers for a special issue. And of course you need someone to actually make the call and do a paper about that. And that ended up being me. So I thank also Jim Peterson for shepherding me through the process. So this is actually the proofs for the paper that's gonna come out in September. And here it gives the call for papers on this issue, the special issue, Reconciliation, Ecology, and the Anthropocene. And so you as a potential author are to look at the content of the paper, which is coming out very soon. And then if you're interested, contact me or just write a paper, 5,000, 8,000 words. Easier said than done. And then the best essays will go on to peer review. And we had an environmental issue, special issue about 10 years ago that Dorothy Boris edited. So it's time for another one because we're in the Anthropocene. So back to the garden. God did tell us to serve and protect the earth. And this is where we get this reconciliation ecology, because things have gone wrong. And Jesus was actually in the garden, if you think about it, because the Trinity, Jesus was there. And interestingly, Johann in this painting represents Jesus the way he's represented sometimes as a peacock. So you can see the peacock quite close to Adam and Eve there, right over there somewhere. And interestingly, the symbol was chosen because peacock was supposed to be incorruptible, like Jesus was resurrected, incorruptible. And Augustine even tells a story of how he was served peacock and couldn't finish it. It was put away for a while, maybe a week or two, and it still was fine. I don't try this at home, but that's the symbol, the peacock. So this story starts with a dark and stormy night. We were driving to Abbotsford to visit my son. This is the Fraser Valley where Trinity Western is. and it seemed like a lot of rain. It turned out it was two atmospheric rivers hitting us at the same time. And then we awoke to this. I could hardly get onto campus, but of course Trinity Western had no idea this was coming. Nobody did. And it was actually the worst natural disaster in British Columbia history. And it did rain a lot, and it's a 100-year flood. And my pastor said to me, well, it was a 100-year flood, kind of dismissing it, like, oh, it won't happen again. But then the research that came out showed that it was much more likely, 45% more likely to happen. So 100 shrinks into a lot less because of climate change. So this is the sins of the Anthropocene, that we are creating these flooding issues. And I was already doing research on the Chilliwack River, so I went over to the river and saw the damage from the flood. The river actually changed course and all this debris came along. And that cost of the costliest disaster in BC history is calculated on insurance claims. But the cost will continue long into the future, I know, as a weed scientist, because the river carried the propagules of this knotweed plant that you aren't even allowed to spray along the river, and the number of patches multiplied by 5 times. So my whole research career has kind of pivoted. Before that, I studied climate change and weeds from an academic perspective. Now it's real. So it's really interesting to get into the real matter of it. And last year, me and a student presented some of this at this meeting. You can see here many more patches of knotweed cropping up, and eventually they will get much bigger. And this is Sarah, who co-presented with me last year. And my students, this project has got really big now, but it's the reality that this problem is getting worse and worse, and it's climate change that's causing it, the sins of the Anthropocene. So you'll see the first section in the paper is the Anthropocene for real? And Paul Cruzan, who came up with the term, said it's a pity we're still officially living in an age called the Holocene, because this is already an undeniable reality. We're in the Anthropocene. And when you look at the accelerating pace of human economy, you see global energy consumption going up a lot. Here, the case is being made for 1950 as the beginning of the Anthropocene. Carbon dioxide, of course, going up, as we just heard about. Another interesting indicator is cement. To me, cement is a great indicator of human activity and human modification of the earth. As you see in New York, fortunately, someone had the foresight to put a park in the middle of New York. Otherwise, it would be totally a concrete jungle. And then you can look at all these other indicators. And it's interesting, whereas the population since 1900 has gone up 4.5 times, our footprint is massive, as you see, the global GDP. And we talked about this here Friday about is GDP the issue of what it creates. So we have all these indicators of the great acceleration. And so there's a group of geologists mostly that formed the Anthropocene Working Group to come up with a place to mark this change all over the world. And the winning site was actually near our conference last year, Crawford Lake in Ontario, where I'm originally from. And thanks to Bob Geddes' willingness to make a detour on the pre-planned trip, Crawford Lake was announced as the site. So a bunch of us, including some of us in this room, got to visit this site. We didn't get to actually see the lake, but we made for a nice photo op in front of the sign here. And this is why this lake is so effective as a marker, because it has these sediments that are laid down. It's a very deep lake, unusually deep for its size. And it picks up signals, like even the plutonium from the first nuclear test that you saw if you watched the movie Oppenheimer. So unfortunately, despite all this hullabaloo about the Anthropocene and a lot of work that group went to, some other geologists decided we're not going to count that. It's not going to work. But I mean, I think the concept of the Anthropocene is still very much a live concept. but the geologists decided we're not going to have a demarcation like that. And a lot of the teaching I do is of biodiversity, and I teach every year in Hawaii, and I tell this sad story portrayed here, where you had these native species in the most isolated archipelago in the world. Then you had the Polynesians come, and the Europeans come and bring a lot of invasive species. So this is the story I tell to my students every year, and it's just a great lament, the loss of these special creations that we're never going to see again as the native plant taxa get overwhelmed by the non-native taxa. So when we're in Hawaii, this reconciliation, we can kind of see it take place and take part in it. I really like to take the students on expeditions like this where they get hands-on appreciation of what the ecologists are trying to do, or the restorationists, instead of just the academic story. And Jaya here got us weeding for a whole day in this restoration site. It's a lot of work, but this is the work of reconciliation. And this is the work we see in Colossians here. As we stand in the middle of this groaning creation, we pick up the text from Colossians and read a vision for reconciliation, which is somehow more than a vision because it's actively taking place as narrated in these cosmic verses. It's not lamenting the losses or pining for what it could have been. The text is not troubled by the dark storms that have passed over many places on Earth, such as the Hawaiian Islands, and that continue to batter creation, often literally battering the land and sea. Yet the sovereign Lord who inspired Colossians is aware of these dark storms. The Lord stands up in a boat in these raging storms and commands the winds and waves to be still. And the next day after we weeded for Jaya, we planted plants in Hawaii National Park. And it was just such a neat feeling going from trying to clear up the mistake and make things new again. Just like in Colossians again, we see Jesus holding together everything we are trying to pull apart in our avarice and ignorance. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So then the question becomes, if Jesus is holding everything together, where do we fit in? And we find that, as was mentioned in earlier session today, we are his body, the church, and if we acknowledge his headship, things look much better than if we ignore it, and he is the head of the body, the church. And this reconciliation, though, because so many things have happened, partly as Sam documented there, often you can't go back to what Eden was. And here we also got to participate in this project where Becky is leading this thing which involves a hybrid ecosystem. They're using some non-native plants as well as native plants to improve the ecosystem structure. So it's a whole new world, and a lot of it depends on the values, like Sharon talked about. How do you value different ways of doing things? And I've learned a lot about values from my friend Jennifer Grins here, who did her PhD partly under my supervision, and now has released this book, really highlighting land healing as part of the values. So land healing doesn't mean putting it back to the way it used to be. It's making it better. It's this project. And she was trained as a Western scientist, but rediscovering her native values. And we've looked at this system. Jennifer Grenz was in this documentary we filmed as well, looking at the Gary Oak eco-cultural landscape, showing, you know, Adam and Eve were there. We're there in the ecosystem. We are part of what makes it. And there would not be any Gary Oak ecosystem if the First Nations had not been there. So this reconciliation is a complicated thing. And sometimes it seems like it's good to simplify things and just have a decade. We're going to do ecosystem restoration 2021 to 2030, and we're going to come up with a technical solution. So I kind of love this simple diagram because it shows 2021, there's a bunch of problems. By 2030, the end of the decade, everything's going to be fixed. It's all going to be restored. And as was talked about earlier, Laudato Si, Pope Francis warns against just a technical solution. He wants us to consider that any technical solution which science claims to offer will be powerless to solve the serious problems of our world if humanity loses its compass, if we lose sight of the great motivations which make it possible for us to live in harmony, to make sacrifices and treat others well. And this is part of reconciliation. It's this justice, the use of values, and a whole different ways of thinking. And so what is the promise of reconciliation ecology? It's the promise that Jesus will be at the center of it. Of course, the peacock is a marvelous creature, a good representation. And humanity and creation are at a crossroads. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. So as Sam was talking about in the previous talk, what does this mean for our future? Which future are we going to choose as we stand here at the crossroads? And this is the big question in the overwhelming impact of the Anthropocene. We've got to do something, and we do have the resources of Christ. Christ can help whisper in our ear, you know, should we be creating a hybrid ecosystem? What should we do about the massive injustices that are happening? This is our call. And of course, there is hope in all of this. And personally, I derive a lot of my hope from many of you in this room, and at least one of you not in this room who I've seen at other such meetings, Catherine Hayhoe, who says, the bottom line is this: to care about climate change, you only need to be one thing, and that's a person living on planet Earth who wants a better future. And any person living on planet Earth is made in the image of God, and they have this capacity to remember God's words, to keep and till the land, to serve and protect the land, and listen to what God is calling us to do to reconcile things. So my last slide is repeating this call for papers. I look forward to the collective wisdom from anyone who wants to contribute to this. And of course, if for some reason it doesn't, your contribution doesn't line up with this particular issue of, you know, reconciliation, ecology, and the Anthropocene, it can also always be considered for another issue of perspectives. But anyway, I'm just welcoming your questions now, and you can email me at clements@tw.ca. Notice the deadline. My paper, Call for Papers, is coming out in September, and then we hope to publish the special issue in September 2025. So look forward to communicating with many of you on what we can do to really put out a robust issue on reconciliation ecology in the Anthropocene. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, the class really get into it. They love the weeding. Like, once you get into it, you get into a groove, and the people we work with are so thankful. I'm sure you'd be thankful too, but it's kind of a long way to send our class to Pennsylvania. The back? Yes, so the question is, what does reconciliation ecology incorporate beyond just restoration ecology? And that was certainly a question I struggled with a lot as I wrote the paper. What is the distinctive because restoration ecology, of course, is a it's just a secular thing that people do. Reconciliation ecology should be involving the theological aspects of it. There was a, yeah, in my paper I have that list. It was presented earlier in a talk today too, where you it involves some real lament or repentance as well, and you're trying to put together things that have gone seriously wrong. So reconciliation is always about righting a wrong. And that's why I presented the Hawaiian case, just because I couldn't tell the whole story. But to me, my heart just aches every time I think about what happened in Hawaii. And so reconciliation is about doing a lot more than just kind of patching things up. It's a justice issue, environmental justice, and the resources that Christians have. We can pray for creation, we can receive a word from God on what we should do, things like that, that go beyond the simple idea of restoration ecology. It's interesting, my friend I talked about there, Jennifer Grenz, she doesn't even like the word restoration ecology. That's why she prefers land healing, because it allows a lot more flexibility and involvement of humans. I think reconciliation ecology is a three-way thing: God, humans, and creation. Whereas restoration ecology is more just the ecology of it. Hopefully, does that help? Yeah.
Just to follow up on that, I was going to ask that humanity, restoration within humanity, of one human to the other, seems to be also an irreplaceable part of restoration ecology. It has to engage the human component. And in your reference to indigenous wisdom, I'm also thinking of Kimmerer.
Yes.
Sweetgrass book. But there's a wealth of indigenous wisdom on relations of humans to the land that we can draw from. But it seems to me that has to be a part of that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like I didn't mention the word relationship, but relationship to land, that's a key thing. A restoration ecologist could be like a technician that just goes and takes out the weeds and plants, but relational basis of it is just, you are part of that land. The First Nations have been there since time immemorial, and something needs to be fixed that they know about because they're tied to the land. And biblically as well, like there's this relationship to the land that the Bible talks about a lot that we as modern Western people have not paid attention to. Yeah.
Yeah. So you, when you mentioned, like, you know, Anthropocene is kind of like a new term for me, so I think it's kind of cool. You mentioned there was a couple of potential start dates, such as the tritium or the Trinity test, and I think you mentioned the industrial age. But it seems like they haven't settled on an official date. Yourself, when do you consider that to have actually started? And what is it about that time period? What is it? Why would you yourself?
Yeah, so repeat the question.
So what would the actual start of the Anthropocene be?
He's asking about, you know, when did the Anthropocene start? Like, what do I consider it?
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the issue with picking a date. I think there's a lot of controversy about when the date should be, because some people say the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and others mark 1950, as I showed those graphs where the Great Acceleration in 1950. But it could be earlier too. It could be before the Industrial Revolution, because humans have had big impacts. Like in Hawaii, when the Polynesians came, a lot of things went extinct then even. So my own opinion, I don't know, like, 1950 does seem like a pretty good start. Like, it's just the issue with the geologists is, can we really say, you know, it's a whole different period now or not? And there's a lot of disagreement, but I think it's a very useful concept. And I don't know, I guess I'll vote for 1950, but I'm not settled in that.
Why?
Oh, just because there's different arguments for different dates. Like, for me, like, I was born in the 60s, and I just think of the 50s as when humans kind of went off the rails and went a lot of consumerism and that kind of thing. But the Industrial Revolution is also a huge marker. Yeah.
We don't have any more time for questions, but I'm sure David would be happy to talk to you, you know, offline.
Great.
Thank you.